Maybe I'll take this opportunity while the light bulb is getting changed to welcome you all on behalf of the Environmental Faculty Steering Committee to the last of this semester's seminars in the series Research in the Interest of the Public and the Environment. This is a series that is about environmental challenges and their interdisciplinary solutions from the perspective of faculty and students at the University of Michigan. The seminar series is sponsored by the Office of the Vice President for Research and the Urb Environmental Management Institute. Before I mention today's speakers and their title, let me say that the seminar series will continue into the next term. The first of the seminars next term will be January 13th. That's also a Thursday afternoon. The seminars next term will run from 4 to 6 instead of from 3 to 5. They will all be held in the Michigan League, not all in the same room, but all in one of two of the nice seminar rooms over there, and we will have a schedule set by the time of the first meeting. And the first seminar next semester will feature a group of faculty and graduate students who are designing an energy track for the University of Michigan that will involve collaboration among about half a dozen units across campus. By an energy track, I mean a program in research and education at all levels and outreach that focuses on the sources, uses of energy, alternative energies, the problems created by energy use for both technologies and for society. So this is a very interesting subject that has been the focus of several informal meetings over this fall, and we'll hear about that in January. Today we have the theme of sustainable agriculture, and our speakers are John Vandermeer of the Department of Biology and Yvette Perfecto of the School of Natural Resources and Environment. The title of their talk is Challenging Old Assumptions About Agriculture, Finding the Ecological Bases for New Forms of Production.
Okay, thank you, Catherine. What we plan to do here, I don't know if I can do that in the way of this or not, but what we plan to do here is I'll talk a little bit about sort of the underlying theoretical framework that we think we're operating under here. And then when I finish that, that'll just be about 5 minutes or so, and then I'll talk about the work that we're doing in Nicaragua. And when I finish talking about the work that we're doing in Nicaragua, Yvette will talk about the work that we're doing in Mexico. And then finally, when she finishes, I'll come back up here to talk a little bit more reflective about how the theoretical framework fits into the work that we're doing and what we plan to do in the future and how other people might be wanting to join us, okay? So first of all, I guess the first thing that we have to talk about is why agriculture at the University of Michigan. The University of Michigan is an ivory tower school. It's not Michigan State. We're not the Cow College, obviously. We really shouldn't be doing agriculture. And so we have to justify that to some extent, I suppose. Besides the fact that most of the terrestrial surface of the Earth is agroecosystem, whether people like to admit that or not, the truth is that the modern agricultural system, when I talk about the modern agricultural system, I'm principally talking about the agricultural system that has evolved since World War II. Modern agricultural system has been, in fact, and everyone has to admit it, cornucopian. I mean, we now produce more than enough food for every person, way more than enough food for everyone in the world. As a matter of fact, the principal problem with agriculture right now is overproduction. So it has been cornucopian, in that sense, very successful, but successful in very narrow terms. Along with that success has come kind of Faustian bargain that people are beginning to realize now, or a lot of people are realizing strongly at the present time, that Faustian bargain has to do with the problems that agriculture is causing. This was first highlighted by Rachel Carson in her book Silent Spring, which is sometimes cited as the beginning of the modern environmental movement. And you recall that book was mainly about agriculture, as a matter of fact, about pesticides. And more recently, we have been seeing human use. And second of all, we need to get away from this narrow technical specialization where people are cubbyholed into their particular disciplinary units. And we have to get out. Agroecosystems involve all sorts of different disciplines. And so by its very nature, the ecological approach to studying agroecosystems is going to be and needs to be, by its very nature, interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary approach. So this focus that we're trying to develop here is an ecological focus where we're looking at an agricultural
an ecological approach to agroecosystems at multiple scales in multiple disciplines. Okay? That's the background. Now, let me show you some slides to talk about the Nicaragua work that we've been doing. I will definitely need the lights out as much as I can get because my slides will not withstand a lot of light pollution. In the Petén in Guatemala, with a very similar project to the project, actually it's a paired project to the project that we're working on in Nicaragua, but I won't say anything about the Petén site today. And then in addition to that, where Yvette will talk about is work that we're doing up here in the highlands of Chiapas in Mexico. Next slide. This is the National Geographic map that was published several years ago of the forest cover in Native American lands in Central America. And I just wanted to show you, to put this whole thing in context, this is Nicaragua. And as you can see, the Pacific side, or the western side of Nicaragua, is almost entirely deforested. And as you move from the Pacific side to the Atlantic side, while you get more and more forest, although it's a highly fragmented forest, of course, as you can see. Once you get on the eastern side, you see there's a big chunk of forest here. This is the Indio Maíz Reserve, and a big chunk of forest here, the Wawachan Reserve, and non-preserved, they're just rainforests here, okay? But what you also can see is that the agricultural frontier is pushing in through here, and it's kind of cut through the forest right here. We work, in general, in this area right here. Next slide. The context of the work, I did want to show you some aerial photographs to give you an idea of the overall landscape. The landscape itself is really quite heterogeneous. This particular slide here is of a meandering river, meandering through swamp forest. This is all forest here, but it's swamp forest. And then herbaceous swamp that's in through here. This is pretty much natural vegetation, which has not been too influenced by Homo sapiens, other than some sort of traditional agricultural rice production that goes on in the swamp areas. Next slide. Many areas that you find around there in the area are pretty much continuous forest. This forest was damaged by the hurricane in 1988, which I'll tell you about in just a moment. But you do see landscapes like this. The next slide shows you a much more common type of landscape. You see natural forest here, but then you see a patch of agriculture, a patch of forest that's been cut down, ready for slash and burn agriculture here. Here's a patch that's been in agriculture and may have been abandoned. I really don't know. But you see this kind of mosaic there. Next slide. And this is a very common feature here. You see forest in the background and cattle pasture in here. Not very good cattle pasture, but cattle pasture. Next slide. And here you see the mosaic of a combination of forest and cattle pastures. Much of this forest is sort of riparian forest, others of it's highland forest, but also much of this is agroecosystem. You can't really tell that it's agroecosystem, which is part of the point, which I'll get to in just a moment. Next slide. Historically, the area has been not nearly as important agriculturally as it has been for forestry. And wood gets a variety of uses, sort of the artisanal uses of wood, making canoes, which is the only means of transport in the area. There are no roads in the area. It's all by water. Next slide. And here is a family wood production system. I mean, these are crude boards cut with a chainsaw, like that, and they're for sale on the side of the river here. And if you want some boards to build a house with while you come up here with your dugout canoe and you buy them from the person who lives in that house. And in addition, you can see these bags of charcoal also are displayed here in this very nice Kmart-type fashion for anybody who wants to buy a bag of charcoal. Next slide shows we do have your sort of garden variety of clear cutting. So there is some extensive forest cutting going on, although at present time that's sort of stagnated because of a lack of organizational efficiency, I would say. Next slide. The natural vegetation of the area is tropical rainforest, and indeed it's a beautiful tropical rainforest, no question about it. It's highly diverse, although not nearly as diverse as the upper Amazon in Ecuador, but it still is very diverse, and there's no doubt about it. I don't have to go through the litany of all the things that are important about it. It's important aesthetically. It's important in terms of its biodiversity. There's undoubtedly somewhere in here there's a compound which will provide us with a cure for cancer, for AIDS, for anything else you like. Okay, and of course, it also is being chopped down, as most tropical rainforests in the world are being chopped down. The next slide shows, just very briefly, next slide, please, Ness. This is the reason that we originally started working there. In 1989, Hurricane Joan came through the area and turned that tropical rainforest into a landscape more or less like this. That is, there was complete devastation. We went down there, the hurricane hit in October of 1988. In February of 1989, we went down there to do an assessment of the damage that the hurricane had done. And the next slide shows the kind of thing that we found. And the important thing about this slide, to note about this slide, is that these are very, very damaged trees, but they're not dead trees, and that's really the whole point of it. They're resprouting. These are all resprouts here. This is a palm leaf that has resprouted in 4 months. These are all resprouts coming out of these trees. Every single one of these trees that you see here has resprouts coming out of them. And basically, the forest had a tremendous capability for rejuvenating itself after this extensive damage. That led us to ask the question about how damage, or what we call in ecology perturbation, what perturbation or disturbance, how that affects the natural processes of the ecological functioning of a system. Basically, for those of you who know ecological succession, okay. And we've been working on that now for about 10 years, but that's just the background for why we're working there. Now, the results of these studies, looking at this perturbation or this damage that's caused by a natural event, the hurricane, which, by the way, hits this area about once every 100 years, according to what we can figure out from the historical record. And from the point of view of a rainforest, of course, once every 100 years is actually quite frequent. Okay, so the rainforest, naturally, as you would expect, is kind of adapted to be responsive to this kind of a damage event. Now, the question arises, what about other kinds of damage events that you might have there? Like, for example, agriculture. From the point of view of a rainforest, agriculture is a damage event. For us, from the point of view of us, agriculture is something that we do to try and produce something that we can eat or wear. But from the point of view of a forest, agriculture is a damage event. So the idea is to ask, to what extent is the damage event caused by agriculture similar to the kind of damage event that's caused by the hurricane? Can we make any predictions at all? Can we gain any insight about what's going to happen to the forest after agriculture compared to what happened to the forest after the hurricane? Now, in a sense, this seems like sort of a silly thing to do, I know, because agriculture is not a natural damage event or anything like that. The real point here is that agriculture is not permanent. Okay, and contrary to what an awful lot of sort of preservation-minded conservation people would like to think, that once the rainforest is gone, it's gone forever. That really isn't true. That rainforests do, as a matter of fact, come back, and the question of how they come back is a very important question for the future. And the one thing I always like to cite is that one tropical country that everybody knows of in the world that has had, in the past 30 years, has had an actual increase in cover of forest. The only one in the world, everybody knows what that is, right? Tropical country that has had an increase in forest cover in the past 30 years.
Costa Rica.
No, Costa Rica has had one of the highest rates of deforestation.
Sri Lanka?
No. This is good. Keep guessing. I don't have time to let you guess until you go through all the countries. And I guarantee you won't get it. It's Puerto Rico. There's a pretty obvious reason why, okay? And the reason is that Puerto Rico went through its industrialization program. I don't want to defend its industrialization program, especially in front of Yvette. But it did, in fact, go through an industrialization program, and people just left the countryside. And so the notion of a Puerto Rican landless peasant looking for a piece of land to form a farm on is pretty silly, if anybody knows who knows anything about Puerto Rico. So the whole industrial program in the 50s in Puerto Rico caused people to move into the cities, caused development, albeit a fairly unequal and sort of distorted form of development, but people left the countryside, and indeed the forest came back and is still coming back. We have much more forest cover in Puerto Rico than we did 30 years ago.
Is any of this a protected reserve?
No. That's not... I shouldn't say none of it is protected reserve. Some of it is, yeah, but that really isn't the major part of it. The major part of it is, well, I don't want to tell you what the major part of it is because it would give away what I'm going to say next. So the logic of what we're trying to do here is that, you know, when we're thinking of forests, we're thinking of long-term things. And we're thinking of landscapes, we're thinking of long-term things. And so agriculture isn't forever. It really isn't. And we don't know what's going to happen either in the Petén of Guatemala or in Nicaragua. Who knows? They might industrialize soon. I doubt it, but they might. Who knows? We might even have the kind of government which will permit us to plan land use better than the current governments do. But when any of that happens, it will be useful for us to know what, as a matter of fact, are the processes that happen in the post-disturbance phase of forest recuperation when the disturbance is agriculture itself. Now, it's not just agriculture. There's agriculture and there's agriculture. There's a variety of different kinds of agriculture that occur in the region. That's the rationale for the project. Let me just go quickly through the types of agriculture that there are in the region. Next slide. First, we have your standard sort of slash and burn agriculture, where you cut the forest down. Next slide. You set it on fire. Next slide. It burns. Next slide. Try again, focus before I say next slide. It might not be easy. So you have your nice burned area, and the next slide, then you, in this burned area, while you have this wonderful ash here, which is really rich with nutrients, the next slide, you take and you plant your corn and beans, and in the case of Central America, usually, or some other crop, you plant that right into the ash. The next slide shows you your little plants coming up through this wonderfully nutrient-rich ash. The next slide then shows the kind of production you can get out of this the first year, at least. Now, this is not a small person. This person is 6 feet tall, okay? And this is the corn that you get out of there. That's the first year worth of production in a slash-and-burn system, which is very, very high production. However, the soils are of the type, as probably most of you have heard, they don't have a great nutrient-holding capacity to them, so the first rainy season comes, and the nutrients all either flow out or flow down to the deeper levels. And the second year, you might get a cornfield that looks like this, which you can see that there's a difference there. And the next year, something sort of like this. And at that point, what do? At this point, the nutrients are all leached out of the system. The weeds are all coming into the system. The pests are all coming into the system. And you're not left with much left to do but migrate onto a different place. This is the classic migratory slash and burn agriculture. And this is really quite common in the area that we work. It's very complicated, but it's common. Okay, that's one kind of agriculture. Second, we have, at the other extreme, actually, we have a very modern form of agriculture. This is a sugarcane field. This is a very, very monotonous, highly chemicalized form of agriculture. This is what we're referring to as intensive agriculture. This is the closest we have to what you would call the modern model of agriculture, with large amounts of chemical fertilizer and chemical pesticides applied to the system. Next slide. In addition, there's a sociological component to the whole thing, sociological economic component to the whole thing. These are mosquito Indians that migrate into the area every year to cut the cane by hand. Okay, another very important component of the whole process. So that's the second kind of agriculture. First of all, you have slash and burn. Then you have intensive agriculture. Next slide. Thirdly, you have cattle pastures, the famous cattle pastures that are eating away into the rainforest. Next slide shows a cattle pasture that we're working in. These cattle pastures tend to be highly degraded. They tend to degrade fairly rapidly once they're set up as cattle pastures. That's the third kind of agriculture. And then fourth, well, I'm standing in a cattle pasture right here, and I'm taking a picture of this. Well, that sort of looks like second growth forest or something like that. Well, the point is that is also an agro-ecosystem. Okay, that is a traditional agroforestry agroecosystem. The next slide shows a slide from inside here. And as you can see, there's a coconut tree here. This is actually a timber tree that was planted, another timber tree that was planted. There's fruit trees all over the place. Next slide shows a component of this system. This is the owner of the farm. His name is Daniel Cuthbert. And, one of the things that you have to do when you visit his farm is you have to eat coconuts, and he's up there cutting coconuts down for us, another sociological component of all of this. Next slide shows a piece of the farm in what you might call a light gap inside of the farm, where you have this kind of production. That's not really a crop, but this is, for those of you who know the terminology, this is a buen monte, actually. This is what he calls a good weed. This is heliconia, which sort of keeps out the bad weeds. And when you chop this down, when you plant corn and beans in here, And then you let this go back to fallow after you do that. That's just one component of the whole thing. And you can see the coconut trees on either side of it. These coconut trees are in the process of growing up. This field will not be a corn and bean fields after these things grow up, but then some other part of the farm will. So it's sort of a little bit of shifting cultivation right within the farm itself. Okay, this is what we refer to as a traditional agroforestry system. Next slide shows another example. Here we have what's a combination of a pasture with fruit trees. This is what's called a silvopastoral system. Again, a very traditional form of production in the area. And you have all these fruit trees around here, fruit trees and timber trees also, and the cattle graze underneath them. This is a system that's been in operation at this one site on these supposedly very bad soils for at least 30 years without any kind of a rotation system going on at all. Okay? So what we have these four systems of agriculture. We have this traditional slash and burn, we have the intensive agriculture, the sugar cane, we have the cattle pastures, and we have the traditional agroforestry systems. Now, the idea of the research is to ask the question, what happens when each of these types of agriculture is abandoned? Does the same thing happen in all cases, or is it the case, as I strongly expect, that this kind of system, when abandoned, will lead to a totally different process of forest regeneration than, for example, the sugarcane field will? And that's the context of the research. I won't go into any more details about it because I want to talk just a little bit before my time runs out here. I want to talk a little bit about some of the bigger contextual elements of it. And that has to do with the sociopolitical aspects of what's going on in this region of Nicaragua. And I will add that there are equal complexities in the place that we work in Guatemala also, but I don't have time to go into those. Next slide. This is a small fishing community on the coast. This is called Tasba County. This is where the Miskito Indians live, where some of the Miskito Indians live. Next slide shows it's actually a very, very picturesque place. Looks like sort of like paradise until you realize that there are crack addicts all over the place, but that's another story. Next slide. This is what they do for a living. This is one of the things they do for a living. This always gets conservationists really, really upset. But I must say that the dent that the Miskito Indians make into the sea turtles is far, far, far less than the dent that the WTO is making into them. Next slide. I had to get something about the WTO in this talk, of course. This is Ralston. He's a Miskito Indian. And what I'm really talking about here is I'm talking about the ethnic complexity of the area. Okay. The Miskito Indians constitute a small but very significant minority of the people in the southern Atlantic region where we work. They fish, and they do forestry. They do some agriculture also, but it's mainly fishing and forestry that they do. And this slide, I can't tell the whole story here, but this is a woman who was cutting this forest down. And this forest belongs to the Tasba County people, traditionally belongs to the Tasba County people. And here, Ralston is having a fairly intense debate with the people who are cutting it down about whether or not they should be cutting it down. Next slide. This is another ethnic group. This is perhaps the most common ethnic group, about 45% of the population. These are Creole people. They speak English. Oh, the Miskitos, by the way, speak mainly Miskito, but also Spanish. And some English. This is the Creole population. Their first language is English, but they mainly speak Spanish also. This is Miss Mora, who is one of the farmers that we work with. And this is her grandbaby. This is Brent Chinsky. Next slide. These are more kids. These are kids from Pearl Lagoon, which is another Creole community in the area. Now, the Creoles are fisher people. They also work on boats the merchant marine type thing, and they're also farmers. They're not the most common farmers in the area, but they are the most common traditional farmers in the area. Next slide. This is the next most common ethnic group, probably about another approximately 45%. These are the mestizos. These people are of mixed blood, usually Spanish and Native American of some sort. This is Lorena and her husband, Don Sergio, and these are their three kids. These are the people that we work with in one of our farms also. Next slide. And this is the community at another one of our sites, the Fonseca sites, for those of you who know the site. Again, these are mestizo people. So you have basically these three major ethnic groups, the Miskito Indians who speak Miskito, the Creoles who speak English, and the mestizos who speak Spanish. In addition to that, next slide, you have some smaller groups. Excuse me, this is another mestizo kid. This is, I can't remember his name, but he lives at one of the farms we work on also. Next slide. This is a small group of Native Americans. These are the Rama Indians. There are several small communities very near to where we work. We don't work directly with any of the Rama Indians, though. Next slide. And this is a group of, a very curious cultural group, a really interesting cultural group, the Garifuna. These are the people that were escaped slaves from French colonialism, and they've devised their entire, their own culture in Central America. They're mainly concentrated in Belize, but they also have major communities in Honduras and two small communities in Nicaragua. We don't work with them either, but they're in the area. Next slide shows you just another Garifuna, a Garifuna girl. I thought it was kind of a nice slide. Okay, the next slide shows you, this is symbolic of the kinds of things that we face here. This was on what they call an almendro tree, a Dipteryx panamensis, and this tree was, as you can see, it's burnt here, right? This tree was a traditional individual tree that Ms. Mora and her husband, Mr. Cloyd, gathered fruits from every year. They gathered fruits from this tree every year, and they used the fruits to make a juice, and they used the fruits for a variety of things. So this is a tree in the natural forest that they traditionally used. Now, a mestizo family migrating in from the Pacific side, remember that's where I told you where most of the people were, a mestizo family migrating in from the Pacific side decided that this would make great charcoal. So this is the way they kill this tree, so that it falls down so they can chop it up and make charcoal out of it. And the reason I'm telling you that story, and I could have told you a variety of other stories, there's tremendous ethnic tensions that are happening right now on the Atlantic coast of Nicaragua. The mestizos against the mesquitos against the Creoles against the mestizos. And this is symbolic of what's happening there. That's part of the whole story, that's part of the whole context within this research, within which this research is happening. And finally, next slide. Once again, the slide of Nicaragua pointing out the difference between the Pacific coast and the Atlantic coast. We work on the Atlantic coast, which is where rainforests are. It's dry on the Pacific coast, and which is where most of the people live. Now, traditionally, there have been incredible antagonisms between the people on the Atlantic coast and the rest of Nicaragua, because the people on the Atlantic coast are Native Americans and Creoles, for the most part, and mestizos who have lived there all their life. They regard themselves as a different culture. They refer to themselves as costeños, or coast people, and they refer to the people on the Pacific side, as a matter of fact, they refer to them as the Spaniards. And so there's a tremendous division between the Atlantic coast and the Pacific coast, and because of the neoliberal model that has been imposed on the Pacific coast of Nicaragua through their current administration, there's enormous pressure for peasants who used to have their own land here but now are being kicked off their land because of this new model, and the only place that they could go is to the Atlantic coast. So you have new mestizos coming into the Atlantic coast and doing things like burning the almendro trees, and that is creating all sorts of new ethnic tensions. The historical division really is between the coast and the Pacific side. The new divisions are amongst the various ethnic groups. So that's the overall context. That's the research project that we're doing. And now I'll turn it over to Rita.
Okay, I think I need to change. Okay, well, you can see now, or begin to see, that our more general theme of both Joan's research and my research is related to the interaction between agriculture and natural areas, or between agricultural activities and conservation activities. And that is illustrated also with this other project. And I have, are you okay with doing this? Okay, well, I think that when we look at agriculture from an ecological perspective, one of the main things that we have to do is figure out what's there, what organisms live there, and what are their functions. And this is a spider, of course, which is an important predator in many agricultural systems. Can I go next one? When we think about agriculture, I think if I ask you to envision an agricultural system, most of you are going to envision something like this. Primarily intensive agricultural production, monoculture, very, very low diversity of crops, and something pretty much like this. However, there are many agricultural systems that are highly diverse. Next one. And one of them is the system that John called slash and burn agriculture. I call shifting cultivation. And shifting cultivation
is a very important system that is practiced. I think it's about 500,000 people in the world, 500,000,000 people in the world still practice this type of agricultural system. It's one of the main agricultural systems, and it covers about between 300 and 400 million hectares in this kind of system. This is the kind of system that is very dynamic because after, like John mentioned before, you have this kind of agriculture going on, but it cannot goes on continuously. After a few years, it gets abandoned, and then you let it fallow for anywhere from 2, 3 to 40 years, depending on the region where you are. Okay, so you have this kind of system. You have other type of systems, like this is an agroforestry system similar to the one that John showed you before. Very diverse type of systems. Next one. So my approach, or our approach in studying biodiversity in agroecosystem, is to look at biodiversity as having two main components. One is the plant biodiversity, and that's basically the crops. That is the things that the farmer include in the agroecosystem intentionally. And the other one is the associated biodiversity. Those are the things that live there because the plant biodiversity creates the conditions for those other organisms to live there. Those are the spiders, those are the microorganisms in the soil, et cetera, et cetera. Both of these type of components of biodiversity promote the functioning of the agroecosystem. And I think that in agroecosystem, the functioning, when we talk about the functioning of agroecosystem, it actually makes more sense than in a natural system, because you know what the function should be. And in this particular case, for example, the pest dynamics, nutrient cycling, even including some of the other aspects of an agroecosystem, socioeconomic aspects of agroecosystem like market efficiency or risk minimization and that kind of functioning. Can I have the next one? So most conservation biologists, when they look at agroecosystem or when they think of agroecosystem, they pretty much, a lot of the literature assumes that the loss of diversity with the intensification of agroecosystem is something like this, that there's a dramatic decrease in biodiversity as agroecosystems get intensified, or as you transform a forest or a natural area into an agriculture area. However, there are very few studies that have looked at the loss of biodiversity in different type of agroecosystem, comparing them with the forest or the natural vegetation that used to be there before. And we can have, these are four possibilities of the way biodiversity is lost with the intensification of agriculture. And the main idea here is that we really don't know how biodiversity is lost. And the other thing is that possibly many different organisms or different organisms in different taxa are going to respond differently to the disturbance or to the intensification of the agroecosystem. Can I have the next one? Okay, so that's what brings me to the case study that we are studying, and that is coffee. Why study coffee? Well, next one. I'm used to it. Well, coffee is a very interesting crop. Let's call it a crop. It's a very interesting crop because in its traditional form, it's cultivated in an agroforestry system. Very, very diverse system with a lot of trees that are used as shade trees. Coffee originally was domesticated from the understory of upland forest, and when it began to be grown and domesticated, it was grown under the canopy of trees. So you have these very diverse systems. Can I have the next one? And one of the most important things related to coffee is not that much the extension of land that is covered with coffee plantations, mm-hmm. like the one you saw before, but the actual location of specifically Coffea arabica, which is one of the main species of coffee that is cultivated. And this is what is called café de altura, or coffee that grows in the highlands. And in Mexico, for example, this is southern Mexico. And these areas here, the dark areas, represent areas that the CONAVIO, which is the conservation agency in Mexico, have designated as highly important for conservation purposes because they have a lot of endemic species or because they have a very high biological diversity. Those areas correspond, this is a study that was done by Moguel and Toledo, and they correspond pretty much to the main area where coffee is produced in Mexico. So, and many of these plantations that are distributed throughout this area are like the one that I showed you before, highly forested plantations that preserve or conserve a lot of the species that live in the conservation areas. Can I have another example of the importance of coffee you can find in El Salvador. El Salvador, a Central American country, these are the coffee plantations, the distribution of coffee plantations in El Salvador. It turns out El Salvador is one of the most deforested countries in the world. It turns out that the only forest that is left in El Salvador are coffee plantations. About 85% of all the forest, what is classified as forest in El Salvador, are for coffee plantations that are in production. And the rest of the forest was cut down long, long time ago. Can I have the next slide? And that's why the proposal for the biological corridor, which is part of a Conservation International proposal to connect many areas, conservation areas throughout Central America, it basically includes the areas that are coffee plantations for El Salvador, because there's very little natural forest that is left in this country, except for the coffee plantations. So these plantations, the shaded plantations, are very important for conservation purposes in many of the Central American countries. Now, this is not, I couldn't find a slide of the disease that I wanted to show you, but in the 1950s, there was, in Brazil, there was a problem with coffee production because of a disease, the coffee rust, that came from Africa and started devastating coffee plantations there. They started a breeding program to try to come up with varieties that were resistant to the coffee rust. And they came up, next one, next slide. They came up with varieties that were resistant to the coffee rust, but then it turned out that actually coffee rust was not such a big problem after all, at least for other countries. But these new varieties of coffee had another characteristic, and it was that they were high-yielding varieties as well. They yield much, they produce much higher yields than the traditional varieties, but it was a whole technological package. It's not just that they could be continue to be producing the same system, they had to change the whole production system. And in the case of Central America, what they started doing was eliminating the trees, the shade trees. So these are high-yielding varieties that produce much higher yields of coffee, but then you have to eliminate or reduce significantly the amount of shade where this coffee is grown. Can I have the next one? And so it's a whole process of technification, of what was called coffee technification, started in Central America and Mexico and Northern South America. Many plantations that look like this now look like this. They eliminated all the trees. This is the most intensive type of transformation, obviously. But in Costa Rica, for example, a lot of the plantations, about 20 years ago, a lot of the coffee plantations used to look like the other slide that I showed you, like a forest. And now they look like this. Costa Rica has been one of the countries that really intensified their plantations, especially in the Central Valley, which is the prime coffee-growing region in Costa Rica. Colombia was another country. Can I have the next slide? This also includes, it's not just the elimination of the trees or the reduction of the shade, but also the application of a whole variety of agrochemicals, fertilizers, herbicides, and insecticides, etc. Obviously, you don't have just those two systems that I showed you before. There's a whole gradient of different systems that you can find throughout Central America. And, you know, from the very rustic traditional plantations that have a very high diversity and dense shade to specialized shade. These are not complete monocultures of coffee, but they have, their shade is just one species of tree, and that's it. And in this particular case, they didn't include the monoculture because in Mexico, they don't practice that much. You hardly ever see any monocultural plantations in Mexico, but there's a whole gradient of different systems. Can I have the next one? Okay, so this is a technification of coffee in Northern Latin America, and you can see that it has been a gradual process, but the countries that have really intensified a lot of their plantation have been Colombia primarily and Costa Rica with a large percent, about 40% of their plantations, but about 90% or 80% of their plantations in the Central Valley of Costa Rica were transformed to highly intensive coffee plantations. Thanks. So given this context then, obviously, one of the things that we started asking us, what is the impact of this on biodiversity? What's happening with all this diversity? Obviously, we know that the plant biodiversity or the crop diversity is going to be reduced dramatically in the case of those monocultural plantations from like 100 species of trees that were living in the system before to one species, which is coffee only. But also, what's going to happen to the associated biological diversity? Can I have the next one? So we conducted, just to find out what was there, what's up there in those trees that we are definitely going to lose because you're eliminating those trees, you're eliminating the habitat for those species. So we started with a very simple survey of trying to find out what's up there. And we use a methodology that is used commonly for studies of arthropods in the canopy of forest, because we wanted to compare our data with that of forested habitats in the tropics as well. So basically, you fog the canopy of the tree with an insecticide, unfortunately, and then the insects start dropping here, you collect them, and then you quantify them. Can I have? Excellent. Okay, and just to give you, I won't go into the data that extensively, but just to give you an idea of how dramatic this is, in one single tree that we fought, one single tree, a relatively small tree of Erythrina porpillana, which is one of the common shade trees in coffee plantations in Costa Rica, we found 30 different species of ants, 333 individuals, 126 different species of beetles living in the canopy of a single shade tree in a coffee plantation. And 103 different species of wasps, mainly Microhymenopterans. And then we found another individual of Erythrina in the same plantation, about 200 meters from this one, and we found 27 species of ants, 110 species of beetles, and 61 species of wasps. But the most impressive thing was also that the overlap of species between these two trees, for example, the beetles, less than 20% overlap of species in these two trees. So what are those things doing up there, all these beetles, most of them undescribed? We don't know. I mean, it will take a lifetime to find out, to figure out what are these things doing in the canopy of these trees. But what we do know is that you're going to lose all of those species with this transformation of the agroecosystem, of that agroecosystem. Can I have the next one? The next step then was to figure out, well, that happens, we know that we're gonna lose all those species up there that are in the canopy. What's gonna happen to species or to groups that are slightly more resistant or that live in other areas that do not need the trees really to nest or something like that? So we started looking at the ground foraging ant community. They nest in the ground. They go up to the plants and forage in the plants or forage in the ground. So they shouldn't be that affected by the transformation. Can I have the next one? This is just to give you the trend that we found. These are different categories of plantation going from the monoculture to the more diverse plantations, with different indices of diversity here. And you can see that there was a significant increase in terms of biodiversity of ground foraging ants in these different plantations. But another thing that was important from our studies in Costa Rica was that even though on a plot basis, let's say we do a study of the ants that are in a particular plot, 7 by 7 meters only, and you find about 10 to 12 species of ants in that plot. In a system like this, in a diverse agroforestry system, every time you do that type of sampling in a different plantation, you also find more or less the same number of species of ants, but they tend to be different species. So the beta diversity or the regional scale type of diversity, the heterogeneity of ants in this area, when you have traditional plantations or shaded plantation, is much higher than for the monoculture. If you have, can I have the next one? In a plantation like this, we found on the average about 4 species using the same methodology, 4 species per plot, but every time they were the same species. You go to this plantation and then you go 3 miles down the road to another plantation, do the same baiting, the same thing happened, more or less the same species. So at the landscape level, then, the impact of transforming very diverse shaded plantations to monocultural plantations is very significant. Can I have the next one? Okay, so at the same time that we were doing that kind of study, other people were studying other organisms in coffee plantations. There were studies looking at epiphytes in coffee plantation that found a very high diversity of epiphytes in shaded plantations, the next one, and also birds. There were studies that were looking at diversity of birds in shaded coffee plantation that documented a very high diversity of birds in the shaded plantations. And the next one, it was precisely birds that captured the imagination of the general public, of course, being the charismatic fauna that they are. It caused a lot of attention, and in particular because the Smithsonian Migratory Bird Center was doing some of these studies. And the Smithsonian Migratory Bird Center documented, primarily Russell Greenberg from the Migratory Bird Center, documented how important these plantations were for migratory birds that were coming during the winter months. And they, in 1996, they had a conference with several workshops, and one of the main purposes of this conference that the migratory bird, they call it the Sustainable Coffee Conference, and one of the main purposes of the conference was to talk about this transformation that was happening throughout Central and Northern Latin America, and also to come up with some alternatives to try to maintain the plantations as shaded plantations rather, or prevent that these plantations would be converted to coffee monoculture or their shade would be eliminated from the system. And can I have the next one? Out of that conference came a whole series of different alternatives, and one of them was this person who owned Thanksgiving Coffee. He began marketing his coffee. He began visiting the farms where he was buying coffee from, and basically marketing the making sure that these were shaded plantations, and then marketing the coffee as Songbird Coffee. Shade grown, you can see here, say shade grown coffee. So this was one of the ideas that came out of this conference, was to look at the coffee market and try to stimulate the conservation of these shaded plantations through some market forces, like, for example, trying to stimulate people to buy shaded coffee. Can I have the next one? And so a whole variety of different systems started to appear. This is, for example, EcoOK, which is the Rainforest Alliance. They developed a certification program. They went a step further from Thanksgiving Coffee, and they developed a certification program with a whole series of criteria that were based on the studies that have been done on biodiversity in coffee. That had to do with the shade, the height of the trees, the diversity of trees, et cetera, et cetera. And they go to these plantations, they check for those criteria. If the plantation passed those criteria, they give them a seal, that is an ECOOK seal, and then they sell it as shade coffee. Can I have the next one? The Smithsonian came up with their own idea, and that was basically they started a venture with the Audubon Society, and they started also certifying coffee as shade-grown coffee. So these were the main things that were coming out of that conference, essentially using these market forces to try to, first of all, educate people about the way coffee is being transformed and the impact that has on biodiversity, primarily on birds in this particular case, but also to try to promote the consumption of coffee that is shade-grown, bird-friendly, biodiversity-friendly, environmentally friendly, or whatever you want to call it. Next slide. This is just, I'm going to go through this pretty fast, but these are just some examples of the kind of interest that all that has generated. Even here in Ann Arbor, in your Caribou coffee shop, you can see the rainforest blend coffee, which also they argued that this is coffee that is grown under shade trees, and if you buy this coffee, you're helping preserve biodiversity because it's shade grown. And so, can I have the next one? So we have, these are the shaded plantations. Can I have the next one? I forgot what is. Oh, okay. What I was going to say with this is that the one problem with this is that there is shade and there is shade. How can you tell that the plantation, the coffee you're drinking is coming from that type of really, very dense forest, or if it's coming from something like this, which also has shade? I mean, this can be certified depending on whether it's certified or not, or whether this is a shaded plantation. So the idea now is to try to fine-tune a little bit more this issue of the shade and see, well, really what level of shade do you need to support higher levels of biological diversity? And that's why we started, how much time do I have? 15 minutes? Okay. So that's when we decided that it was time to move on from Costa Rica and go to Mexico. Can I have the next one? And so we started this project in Mexico just about a year and a half ago. And here is a map of Mexico. We're in Chiapas, which is the southern part of Mexico. And so this is the state of Chiapas. And within Chiapas, we're working very close to the frontier with Guatemala here. And so in this whole area, which is called the Soconusco region, it's one of the primary coffee growing regions of Mexico. Now, why go to Mexico? It's several reasons. First of all, coffee is one of the most important crops in Mexico. It's the second most important generator of income in Mexico after petroleum. Coffee overall in the world is the second most traded commodity after petroleum. So it's a very important, economically, it's a very, very important crop. And in Mexico, it's extremely important, and it has been very important for many years. Next one. It's also, Mexico also didn't have a very strong program for technification. So what you find in Mexico is a lot of areas that, a lot of coffee plantations that are shaded plantations, and also because the topography where coffee is grown, at least in this region, in Chiapas, the topography is so steep that there are many areas that cannot be cultivated at all. So you have a lot of fragments of forest distributed throughout the whole area, throughout the whole coffee growing region. Things like it. In some cases, it's small fragments that are there to protect the watershed, and in other cases, it's just because it's just impossible to cultivate because it's so steep. People cannot get there to harvest the coffee, so they just leave it in the natural forest. Next one. In addition to that, about 80% of the coffee farms in Mexico are managed, are small farms, less than 5 hectares. So if you develop a program that will benefit the producers, it will tend to benefit more people if in Mexico than in other places like El Salvador, there are a lot of large producers. And also about 60% of the population in Mexico that produces coffee in Mexico are indigenous people as well. Can I have the next one? The other thing important about Mexico is that they have the most important market of organic coffee. And most of these are the different organic coffee cooperatives. They are all cooperatives, primarily of indigenous people that have organized themselves, and they have developed strategies to market their coffee directly. Because in most cases, you market your coffee through intermediaries. And so the farmer, the producer, ends up receiving a very minuscule part of what you pay here for a cup of coffee. In Mexico, for a whole variety of reasons, people have organized really well, producers have organized really well, and have taken advantage of the increase in the organic market, and they are marketing their coffee as organic coffee, and they have these cooperatives that have become very, very efficient. And so you already have kind of an infrastructure there, social infrastructure, that could help if you're trying to, in addition to do organic coffee, do something like shade-grown coffee. Certify shade-grown coffee that people will receive a higher price for their production. Can I have the next one? And another thing that attracted us to Mexico, of course, was that, as you know, in 1994, there was an insurrection of indigenous people there, the Zapatista insurrection. This is a poster in San Cristóbal de las Casas that say, el mundo que queremos es un mundo que quepan, en donde quepan muchos mundos. The world that we want is a world in which many worlds can fit. Is that good translation? So can I have the next one? Many, coffee have been a very important crop also for the Zapatistas, for indigenous people that are within these regions that are now autonomous region, autonomous Zapatista region. This is a coffee that you can actually buy in the internet, in the web. It's called Café Zapatista. And they are, at the beginning, they didn't mention anything about shade, and now you read the literature, and one of the main things that they mentioned is that this is shade-grown coffee produced by small producers in the autonomous regions. So this is, with all this good thing going on in Mexico, we decided to go there. And this is a subgroup of the group that's been working there. This is John, myself, Jay West from the biology department, and Dan Griffith from the biology department, and Alex Mass from the School of Natural Resources. Next one. So just very briefly, what we have decided to do now is to study different taxon. As I mentioned before, we're interested in looking at the loss of biodiversity in the different, with the intensification of the system. But one thing that we would really like to look at is how different organisms in different taxa respond to that intensification. So we did some studies with butterflies, next one, with ants, of course, which is what I work with, and with birds. And this is Tom Ditch, who is also another one of, he's a graduate student here that's doing, he's right now in Mexico doing some work with birds in coffee plantations. So I won't get into the details of what we have found up to now, except that basically we're seeing the same trend going from forest, a natural forest habitat, to a more intensive coffee plantation. We have four different systems. The forest reserve, for example, next one. A rustic coffee plantation like this one. This is a coffee plantation. A less shaded plantation like this one, but organic. And the next one, also a less shaded plantation, but that is not organic. So we have those four levels of habitats, let's say. And we have been monitoring the butterflies, ants, and birds in this system. and we started also doing small mammals as well this year. And so basically, we see the same trend in terms of the decrease in biodiversity with the intensification of the system, but each of these taxons respond completely different. One of the things that we're noticing is that, for example, ants seem to be very, very robust. They seem to resist disturbance much more than things like butterflies, for example. And so the response, if you remember the curves of loss of biodiversity that I showed you before, the response of the butterflies is like that, and the response of the ants is like that. So they respond very different. And these are being sampled in exactly the same plots, in the same farms. Can I have the next one? And so the other thing that we are just beginning to look at is the role of these small fragments of forest. Because as I mentioned before, in this region, you have the whole region with a lot of small fragments of forest. We're talking about 10, 15 hectares of forest that are scattered throughout the whole landscape, the agricultural landscape. So what is the role of this fragments of forest in preserving biological diversity, and what is the role of the agricultural matrix in which these fragments are embedded? And in this particular region, the agricultural matrix consists of coffee plantations. That's what's grown there. So we're talking about these fragments of forest surrounded by coffee plantations, and we have different qualities of these matrices. Can I have the next one? So, for example, we started a study in Finca Irlanda, which is an organic farm, fairly shaded plantation that has a small forest fragment. You cannot see the forest fragment from here. Can I have the next one? And this is a map of Finca Irlanda. The plantation that you just saw is in this side here, and this is a small forest fragment that.
That's all Fingerlanda.
This is all Fingerlanda. This is all Fingerlanda here. And this is here is a small forest fragment. There's another forest fragment here. And so what we did last summer was to sample the ants in the forest and then also sample ants a different distance from the fragment in Fingerlanda, which is what we consider high quality matrix because it has a lot of trees, very diverse, very dense shade. And then in the other side of the forest fragment, there's another plantation which have a much lower density of shade trees and is a much more intensive plantation. So we're looking at a very small scale, we're trying to look at these landscape level phenomena. Can I have the next one? And so we have, for example, this is the reserve, is about 15 hectare big, and then these are the plots where we sample the ants. Inside the reserve, in Finca Hamburgo, which is more intensive, and in Finca Irlanda, which is less intensive. And just to give you some preliminary results here, all the black dots are Finca Irlanda, and all the white dots are Finca Hamburgo. And there is a significant difference in terms of the diversity that you find, but also there is a significant decrease in diversity as you go away from the forest. This is distance from the forest. So as you go away from the forest, in Finca Irlanda, you have a significant decrease. Finca Irlanda is what we're considering the high-quality matrix. And the difference was not significant, or the regression was not significant for the other farm, but that's because the drop occurs at very close distance from the forest. So you really have, and we actually had some very small-scale plots looking at the drop of diversity as you get out of the away from the forest, just the first 20 meters or 50 meters, I can't remember. But anyway, you do see a very dramatic drop right at the beginning, and then everything stays more or less the same. So that's one of the things that we're beginning to look at. We're trying to get a grasp at the landscape-level issues as well. Because if you start looking at just, you know, the diversity in the farm, you're missing a big part of what's going on in terms of preservation of biodiversity, at least in this region. Can I have the next one? The next phase of the project is looking at the function of that diversity. what are these things doing in the coffee plantation? And that's going to be, for the next 3 years, I think that's what we're going to be doing primarily, is looking at, in particular, the effect of birds, the diversity and density of birds, most of them, many of them that are herbivores, and the diversity and density of ants and spiders, what impact do they have on the herbivores of coffee. So that's going to be the next stage in this research. And next one. Oh, these are ants eating. Ants are also generally predators. So these are ants eating a caterpillar. And the last thing that I want to say, the last comment, is related to the overall picture. I think that one of the main things that we should not do is lose perspective of the farmer, the person who's making the decision as to whether to have shade or not have shade, or how much shade to have in these plantations. And when we start looking at a system like this from a purely conservation perspective, what our conclusion will be, well, let's have these very shaded plantations. I mean, that's the best thing. That's what preserve the most biodiversity, and we have data that show that those very shaded plantations are the best for preserving biodiversity. But it might not be the best for the farmer. And so we need to look at incorporate the farmer into this whole decision. Can I have the next one? One of the things, let me just go back there. Can I just, I'm sorry. One of the main things here is that even though farmers, especially small farmers, don't base all their decision only on the criteria of yield, yield is one of the criteria that they use. And one thing that we do know, can I have the next one, is that at very dense levels of shade cover, you lose yield. I mean, the productivity of the plant, the yield of the plant goes down when they are grown on under a very dense shade. This is a study that was done by Lorena Soto from Ecosur. And this is for small plantations in Mexico. The curve might be completely different from other plantations in other places. But this is what she found in terms of the level of shade and yield of coffee. And we do know that at certain levels of shade, and actually, you know, going a little bit after 60 or something like that, of shade, that you reduce the yield of the plants. So can I have the last one? So one of the main things here then is to try to come up with some sort of middle point, let's say, or some sort of system that will satisfy the farmer and that will also serve or have some conservation function as well. So it's extremely important to incorporate farmers into this whole process, because they are the ones who are going to make the decision as to whether to have shade or not, or whether to, how much level of shade to have. And so I'm just going to end with this, that the best cup of coffee will be one that will help preserve biological diversity, but also have people at the center of it. So,
yeah. Okay, can I have the lights, please? So basically what we...
Wait. I'm not finished.
not finished, you can't leave yet. We've shown you two specific examples, okay? And they're just two examples, and they're examples of looking at sort of the fine-tuning level of particular aspects of an agro-ecosystem. Going back to the beginning, where I was talking about the approach that we're taking, the agroecosystem, the industrial agroecosystem that we have in our midst today needs to be changed. And one of the reasons that we're making these studies is to understand how agroecosystems work in general, because we're totally convinced that understanding at an ecological level the details of how agroecosystems work is what we're going to need in order to be able to effect change. But when we talk about affecting change, there are various models of affecting change themselves. And the models that we have seen since the World War II have been what I refer to as the auto route models. And the image that I have in mind here is a topographic map. And what we're aiming to do is get from one place to another on the topographic map. So we're here and we want to get to point A. Now, the one way we can get there is we can draw a straight line from here to there. And then we can go and we can follow that straight line. If we're out in the woods following that straight line, we might have to climb down into valleys, scale up cliffs, and crawl through rivers and swamps and everything like that in order to follow that straight line. Or we can blast our way through and create an auto route, a straight line that goes there. But that might not be the best way to do it. Best way to do it probably would be to look at the contours on the contour map and try and get a pathway along the contour to try and get from where we are now to the point over there. Now, metaphorically, of course, what I'm talking about is these contours are the ecology of the system. Agriculture occurs in the context of an ecosystem, and that ecosystem creates these contours, which I believe, and we believe, they act as signposts to tell us where we can make this contour pathway to get from point A to point B. So the model that we're working on for transformation here is to be contrasted with the typical model, that's the auto route model, to be contrasted with that is the contour pathway model. Now, in saying that, I definitely want to say that we're rejecting any sort of romantic notions that what we should be doing is going back to 1939, or back to the last century and the way they did agriculture in the last century. We're not talking about that at all. We're not talking about eliminating all the scientific progress that has been made since that time. We're not talking about eliminating or ignoring the scientific progress that has come since World War II in agroecosystems. Indeed, we reject the notion that many, I think, romantic agroecologists have that we need to reject the scientific approach. Rather, we're saying actually we need more science, we need more technology. It's a question of what kind of science and what kind of technology that we actually need. The kind of science that we need, the kind of technology that we need is that kind of science and technology that enables us to see where these contours are, where these ecological contours are. It enables us to see where the contours are so that we can gently make a pathway through these contours. As opposed to the old model of dominating nature with the auto route and blasting our way through to point B from point A, we need to gently make the pathway along the contours so that we can get to that other point. And to see these contours, we need to approach the ecosystem as the complex system that it is. It is a complex system. And approaching it with the sort of brute force and I would say rather naive reductionist approach that many scientists approach it with is simply not going to work. We all believe in reductionism as a tactic, of course. I'm talking about reductionism as a philosophy. What we need to do is we need to have a thoughtful approach, a creative and thoughtful approach to these very complex systems and to understand them in that way. In putting those two things together, emphasizing this gentle approach to finding the contour pathway and the thoughtful approach towards the complex system reminds me of the comment by Richard Levins that what we really need to approach here in aiming towards the transformation of the agroecosystem is a technology which is not an old technology, but a new technology. As a matter of fact, a more new technology than the technologies that have emerged since World War II. We're looking for a gentle, thought-intensive kind of technology to replace the sort of domineering auto-route kind of technology that we've had in the past. So with that, now you can applaud. And so we would both be happy to take questions.
Any sense how long it takes for re-diversification in an area that's been pretty well wiped out and happened quite quickly again?
Well, I can answer in the case of Nicaragua. I mean, it looks to us like it depends on what the wiping out has been. It depends on what the damage has been. If it's a hurricane, it's all very complicated because in 10 years now since the hurricane, we have much more biodiversity than was there before the hurricane. That's a natural ecological process. What happens after agriculture, we don't know. This project that we have is just underway right now. Our expectation is that the accumulation of biodiversity is going to be larger in the traditional agroecosystem than it is in the other ones, although you know, so far our initial results don't really show that. But we really don't know. We don't know.
Yeah. this graph that you have, four different ways to move from the forest and biodiversity.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, and this is partly a response to just this statement you just made, if you might not have a rise of biodiversity when you move from the forest, you certainly see this with the decline of alpine farms in Europe, decline of rice farms in Japan, where on a larger landscape scale, you've got a rice farm in a valley surrounded by trees. When the farmers go away and the rice stops growing, you get a reduction of biodiversity, reduction of species count on. And the same is true in alpine Europe, where you get, you know, from spruce and farms with lots of birds and different kinds of trees to solid spruce and a reduction in species count. That leads me to another question. What's an operational definition of biodiversity? Is it species richness? How do you know when you got more of it or less of it?
Well, it depends on how you measure it.
Yeah.
But I was using the term biodiversity just in general, meaning all the living organisms there. But obviously, that's not what I was measuring. You know, I was measuring the number of species that were present in a particular plot that came to my dates.
Yeah.
You know, depending on on the method you use to sample the diversity, and then the indices that you use to quantify it. Species richness is one thing that people use frequently, but that just tells you the number of species. It doesn't tell you much about the densities of the organisms or anything like that, just a count of the number of species.
If you could give an incentive to a farmer in the States to diversify his crop, would you do that first of all? Second of all, how would you?
A farmer where? I'm sorry.
In the States.
In the States. Yeah, I would. And I think that it's a very complicated issue because there's all sorts of political and policy effects that a farmer make a decision based on many, many different factors. But I think that one of the problems that we have, like John mentioned at the beginning, one of the main problems in agriculture, and that's particularly true in the United States. You read, you know, the New York Times last Sunday or a couple of Sundays ago, they had a big article on farming in the United States, agriculture in the United States, and farmers are in big trouble, economic trouble, mainly because the price of corn and soybean is so low, and the reason for that is because there's such a high overproduction. So my argument is, well, if that's the main problem, overproduction, then let's achieve a lower production and diversify these systems and have the farmer then at least have a way to, that will give the farmer a little bit more of a way to avoid drops in prices and things like that because they will have a diversity of crops. Now, how farmers here in the United States are going to react to that? Obviously, right now, the way policies are written and all that, there's no incentive to do that kind of thing. The incentive right now is to produce as much as you can in your plot, you know, fence-to-fence production as much as you can, and try to survive with that.
I would like to add to that. I think you also have to look at what causes that, and that's caused largely by political decisions. I mean, the large grain companies, as a matter of fact, are making out like bandits on the whole thing. And the large grain companies, through their lobbying efforts, they were the ones who influenced the change in the legislation from what we used to have in the past, supply management, where farmers were only basically allowed to or receive subsidies to plant a certain amount so that the supply of commodities on the market would be such that the price was set so that they could make a profit. That changed to encourage fence-to-fence planting, so that they actually forced to sell below the cost of production. And then the subsidy comes to the farmer as a payment to make up for the shortfall that the farmer has had. Now, who's actually benefiting from that whole thing? The large grain companies are benefiting like crazy because they get to buy corn and wheat at below the cost of production, which, of course, then translates into the third world because they're now buying corn at way below the cost of production. And even farmers, peasant farmers in Mexico and Costa Rica, cannot compete with farm grown in the United States because that farm is effectively, well, because the large grain companies are effectively subsidized by our tax dollars. But it brings up another issue, which I'm sorry for going so long, such a long answer, but it brings up another issue, and this is something that Yvette and I have talked about quite a lot, and that is the whole this whole question of overproduction in coffee. I do recall several years ago at a coffee conference that we went to in Costa Rica, where there were coffee experts from all over the world, economists, agronomists, absolutely, well, not agronomists really, but economists, sociologists, all people that dealt with coffee, production people, coffee think-up farmer owners and things like that. And everybody agreed. What is the problem with coffee right now? What is the problem with coffee right now? Overproduction. The economists agreed. Economists from right to left agreed. Overproduction is the problem. Overproduction is a problem. Talk to any farmer. What's the problem? Overproduction is the problem. Then you go talk to the agronomist. And you say to the agronomist, what is your main research goal? To increase production. Now there's a contradiction there. There really is. If you look at the history of the way coffee prices have been set, we have precedents in the past for emergency situations. I think I'll cite just one of them, which is World War II, where for political reasons, the United States went into coalition with various other countries to help devise ways of setting production goals for coffee, which would effectively encourage an international supply management system to maintain coffee at a lower production level to save coffee farmers. There's no reason why we can't do that again in terms of biodiversity preservation if people would see the question of biodiversity preservation as an emergency issue like World War II was. But anyway, that's a very long, long argument. So you had a question?
Actually, with the publication of the National Academy of Sciences piece on, I think they called it sustainable agriculture about 4 or 5 years ago, they really talked about traditional methods of diversifying agricultural production for the family farmer in the United States. And so I think the theme is out there about diversified farming. But I really, when I was interviewing family farmers in Michigan for a related project, they would talk about becoming more monocultural as the family structure changed. And so as you got a smaller family or sometimes even single farmers, they tended to go to a less diversified crop because they didn't have the person power. Mm-hmm. I guess my question was related with your coffee examples. What kind of labor is involved, the sort of labor utilization in the sort of the three or four models of cultivation?
Well, that's a very important question. And primarily in Mexico, all this is hand-picked coffee. So none of it is mechanized. None of the coffee is mechanized. And hardly in any place in the world is mechanized either. I mean, there are very few places that have some machines that knock the plants, you know, vibrate the plants or something and capture the beans that fall on the ground or something like that. But for the most part, it's all hand, it's manual labor. And in Mexico, even small farmers that have a 5 hectare, let's say 5 hectare for coffee, 5 hectare is a small farm. So even a farm that is about 5 hectares, they have to hire labor during the peak of the harvesting season. And most of that labor that they hire are indigenous people from Guatemala, migrant workers that come from Guatemala. And in my opinion, if it wasn't for the migrant workers from Guatemala, coffee would have disappeared from Mexico a long time ago. Because there's no, that's the primary hands that pick the coffee.
And currently, going back to Costa Rica, currently all of the coffee in Costa Rica is harvested by migrant Nicaraguan workers.
But then also, for that part of your question was also related to the different system of production. And one thing that there's some studies that have looked at organic coffee, for example. No study have been done to look at labor and the whole economics, including labor, of the shaded plantations. But it has been done for organic plantations, many of which are shaded plantations, and they tend to consume higher labor than the non-organic. And in the case of organics, it's primarily because of the whole the compost, and they have to put the compost in the plants and all that. So it requires a lot of labor. In the coffee plantations that are highly diverse, you also save some labor in terms of weeding, in terms of fertilizing and things like that, because it's a really integrated system. A lot of the canopy of the trees is controlling the weeds, and also a lot of the leaf litter that falls add nutrients to the system, and they don't. And so, especially in weed control, it's a big saving, labor saving method to have that canopy of trees.
This very interesting talk about the agreement of everyone except the agronomists, focuses attention on something we're all interested in. How do you build interdisciplinary activities? How can you organize things to draw that agronomist into a team that tries to work together to increase not just yields, but a balanced kind of production? Got any ideas about that?
No.
The thing is, the schools are highly fragmented. Like, for example, John started this talk by saying, well, we're not MSU. You know, why do agriculture here? And I think that the importance of doing agriculture here is that we have a very different perspective. You go to MSU, and yes, there are people there that are doing sustainable agriculture. There's a whole group of people. But they are like this in comparison to the whole establishment of the land-grant institution. And so an agronomist that gets trained there gets trained in the same, in an agronomy fashion. And so in agronomy schools, I think it's very important to try to come up with this interdisciplinary approach where you don't look at just this single issue, but you look at the whole system as a whole.
I think, you know, that in a curious way, part of the problem might be, just because of the way the history of interdisciplinary research has gone in recent years, part of the solution might be to stop using the word interdisciplinary. Because for so many disciplines, like agronomy, interdisciplinary means I have to put up with a sociologist and an economist for long enough to write the grant proposal to get the money. That's all it means to them. So perhaps if we change the
problem oriented,
look at problem oriented. That's one of the reasons that I talked about the agronomist's point of view and then the ecologist's point of view, and just argue that there's another way of looking at nature, and argue this with the agronomist, that there's another way of looking at nature, and that's from an ecological point of view. And this ecological point of view implies some other things. Now they imply what you and I would probably call interdisciplinary, but we don't necessarily have to say that. You can just say it implies, well, there are these economic problems, there are these sociological problems, et cetera. So just a thought.
When you think of, for example, buildings, organizational structures that would promote this value, you have things like the International Institute of Applied Systems Analysis, which does very good interdisciplinary work, because you've got a lot of disciplinary folks from different regions working on a problem. And people are thinking here now at University of Michigan, what kind of organizational structure should we have that would deal with environmental issues broadly rather than with one specific discipline at a time?
Well, I think this kind of seminars is part of it, because I'm sure there are a lot of people here that are not from the ecological side of things. And so I think it does bring up a lot of interest.
I guess my question about labor utilization was related to that, because when you're talking about development models, which I think John was talking about when he talked about sort of science-based green revolution technology versus a softer impact, the question of, are people going to be sustained? And the sustainability of social structures relates to having a job. So I think one very interesting component of your really fascinating work would be to know what the implications were for the sort of diversity of employment and subsistence opportunities of the different models.
Yeah. Actually, one interesting thing that happens related to this in Chiapas in particular is that coffee, of course, is not a traditional crop from Mexico, but it started by being, it was imported primarily by Germans to Mexico, and usually these were large farms.
and indigenous people started working in these plantations, and that's where they learned how to produce coffee. When many of them started migrating to other places in Mexico, then they started their own coffee plantation, but they learned to do coffee in these areas. And now, as I mentioned, in the Zapatista region, a lot of producers there are coffee producers, and they all were, but a lot of them were workers in the large coffee plantations in the Soconusco area.
Do you guys have enough information yet to know what the relative comparison is between the decrease in diversity from a forest to a shade plantation and the relative increase going from a shade plantation in terms of coffee yield to the high-yielding full-sun varieties? Because, for example, if you could think of the trade-off, if you just looked at yield, you know, just kept yield the same, and the diversity, it might work out that it's better to put more of the shaded plantations into full sun varieties and take that land and put it into, just let it return to natural forests. So if you get a greater yield per unit area, a little bit greater out of that, then you get a species increase.
And what do you do with all the people that depend on coffee for their survival?
I'm just saying.
That's where the other component.
You're producing the same amount. I mean,
in terms of the amount of people that are involved and producing and benefiting from this activity, is much more reduced if you have an intensive coffee plantation. In terms of the amount of coffee that you produce, you're probably right. But then you have to do something with the people that used to produce coffee, and now there's a forest here that they cannot use.
Listen, I would approach that with a multidimensional answer. I agree with Yvette. That is one thing. The fact is you're dealing with facts on the ground here. People produce coffee. Okay, now, if you want to have an industrial program where people are going to stop producing coffee, which did happen in Puerto Rico, okay, that's one thing, but that has to be one component of it. The second component of it is the one that I think you were getting at. And the one that you were getting at was whether you can have this trade-off with producing a lot of coffee over here and still preserving the biodiversity by having all that forest and everything. It turns out that you don't reduce ant biodiversity hardly at all when you go, as you saw, that showed you here, when you go from a forest to a shaded plantation. You just don't. But you do reduce butterfly diversity quite a lot. So it actually depends on what kind of biodiversity you're really interested in, and it's not clear how that actually would shake out. It really isn't. But then there's a third component too, George, and that is this whole productionist mentality. We don't want to produce more coffee in the first place. Okay, there's too much coffee in the world as it is. The price of coffee isn't high enough for most coffee producers to actually make a living. What we're after, what we should be after, is reduction in the production of coffee, not more coffee.
What do you do with the people who, if you reduce yield, what do you do with the people who were working to? I mean, more people work in less productive, less efficient.
Excellent point. I'm glad you brought that up.
Higher price.
The point is, no, what you do with those people, they're on their plantations, but they have shade trees on their plantations, so their production goes down. They have more biodiversity, and in order to satisfy their needs, well, the production goes down first overall, so the price of coffee goes up, so they make more money, and then you have governmental structures, just like we had in World War II, during the Cold War, and other times, where we subsidized production of coffee. It all works out, it really does.
Also, especially in the small plantations, small producers, a lot of the time the shade is also produces something that they use. It's a fruit tree, or there are a lot of fruit trees that they either commercialize or they use for their subsistence. So there's a whole other component to it as well.
Why don't we have one more question, and then we'll break as a group, and anybody else can stay on and talk to John. Let you choose.
Well, it seems that you have exactly the same sort of problem as you do with population of coffee to green. In India, one has the greatest security as a family by having the largest number of children. Globally, for India, it's a disaster. In coffee plantations, what is desirable globally is not optimal for a guy who owns his 5 hectares. He gets more coffee, gets more money, gets more income, employs less labor if he makes a modern agricultural plantation without the biodiversity. So you essentially have to legislate this or impose it so that the individuals can accept this. Because for the individual owning the land, it's not his optimum path.
Just one comment related to that, and that's what the strategy that came out of the Smithsonian addresses. And essentially, their main point is that you have to convince people that they should pay more for this product because the yield is lower. Mm-hmm. So the farmer is not going to want to have a lower yield and still receive the same price. But if you can assure this farmer a higher price for a lower yield, he's going to break even, or he's going to be more or less the same. He's not going to end up losing by having a dense shade in his plantation or her plantation. So that's one of the market-oriented strategies to deal with the problem.
Yeah, that's one strategy, but I think you made a good point there before. The other strategy is a legislative strategy. And the point is, we've done it before. We've done it over and over again before. When the public at large, and especially the political leaders of the world, acknowledge that there's an emergency situation. It happened in World War II. It happened during the Cold War. It happened at several other points also. If biodiversity loss is regarded by the world as an emergency situation, which I think it should be, unfortunately it's not, there is an emergency situation there. We can get the world to legislate the way coffee should be produced. And that's what I think needs to happen. I'm not nearly as sanguine about the market approach that Yvette seems to love so much.
No, I don't. I see a lot of problem with that approach. But that's an approach that actually has received a lot of attention right now.
So you need an OPEC of coffee producers if you want to...
That's what they had in the past, George. That's precisely what they had in the past. The U.S. government organized them.
They had a cartel, a coffee cartel, to manage the price of coffee. But that was eliminated with all these liberalization programs and all that. It was part of the whole.
Along with the WTO.
Well,
on that note, have another cup of coffee on your way out, and let's thank John.